Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in central London. I'm Tim Franks. Sometimes the truth is that news may not feel that new, or to put it another way, not that surprising. And yet, you could make an argument that nothing right now may ultimately be more important than this year's UN climate talks. They've just got underway in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. So a long-scheduled summit has begun. Maybe non-surprise number one. Non-surprise number two is that the figures around the climate are alarming. The UN has today warned that this year will be the hottest on record. And I guess the non-shocks keep coming when you've got the person chairing the talk saying it's a critical moment for the world's climate goals. We may feel we've heard it all before, but does that mean that the sense of urgency and the sense of expectation should be any less? We'll try and assess the mood and ambition at the summit in a moment. First, the president of COP29, as these talks are called, Mukhtar Babayev, opened the proceedings with this call.
COP29 is a moment of truth for the Paris Agreement. It will test our commitment to the multilateral climate system. We must now demonstrate that we are prepared to meet the goals we have set ourselves. This is not easy.
And as for the alarming statistics, Co Barrett, the Deputy Secretary General of the UN's World Meteorological Organization, had this to say to NewsHour.
I don't think we can declare failure at this point, but the trend is not good. You really need to measure these temperatures across decades, not just for a given year. But the trend is pretty significant, and the period from 2015 to 2024 will be the warmest 10 years on record, regardless of whether an El Nino is in effect or not. So this is a cause for alarm.
Matt McGrath is the BBC's environment correspondent. He's a great veteran of these COP climate talks. He's in Baku. How much are the latest climate statistics focusing minds at this summit?
I think people have been making the strong connection between the rise in temperatures that we've been seeing pretty consistently over a number of years now and the impacts that people are seeing around the world and that they've seen in great numbers this year. Those pictures from Valencia in Spain with all those cars piled up and the floods, the power of those floods, the hurricanes in the United States. We've seen storms in various parts of Asia as well. The intensity of the water threat in some respect caused by a warming climate has been really intense this year. And I think scientists here and politicians as well are very aware of that clear link and are making the argument that this is the beginning of a situation which could get much worse and that every fraction of a degree matters. And 2024 is going to be likely the warmest year on record. We're going to be close to 1.5 degrees Celsius above the long-term average. It is concentrating minds a great deal and adding to a sense of urgency here that efforts must be made and that walking away from this meeting in Azerbaijan without some progress would be a bit of a disaster, to be honest.
By what measure will progress be assessed at the end of this COP, do you think, Matt?
I think, unfortunately, the measure will be about the quantum of money, and that's the phrase they use, the quantum of money that will be made available to developing countries by richer countries to tackle climate change. Because it's not just a question of giving money to poorer countries as a kind of an act of charity. This is integral to actually getting those countries, two-thirds of the world, if you like, to improve the offer that they can make on cutting carbon. They can't do it on their means at the moment. They need extra help, and it needs to be significantly above the amount of money they're getting at the moment, $100 billion or so. It's a very, very difficult issue to crack because the richer countries say we want to see the likes of China and the Gulf states pay more in. The Gulf states and China say we don't want to do that. So you're getting into an argument there straight away. And beyond that, then you have the question of will countries put better carbon cutting plans on the table as well? These are really difficult measures in which to get progress. But everybody we speak to here says they have got to get something out of this.
Mm. And in terms of that climate finance, am I right in saying that people are now talking about an order of magnitude more in terms of what is needed for those poorer countries to be able to make the transition?
Yes, absolutely. We used to talk about hundreds of billions, and now we're talking about trillions of dollars needed every year to help countries make that transition to cut their carbon and also cope with those impacts and adapt to those impacts. You know, countries really struggle here. Poor countries really struggle, even though nominally they could be getting a large amount of money. For instance, the Bahamas might strike people as an exotic location, but 5 years ago it was hit by Hurricane Dorian, did $3 billion worth of damage. Now, they get about $100 million a year in aid from various climate funds, but they only are allowed to spend $10 million of that, $10 million, on adaptation. And that's where they need that money. They don't really need the extra money to cut their carbon. They need the money to adapt so that the next time a hurricane hits, they're able to cope with it and not get knocked out for 5 years. So there's a lot of intricacies of the detail of how you get the money, where you get the money from, and how it's spent that are exercising the minds here of a great many people. And there's a hope, I would say a hope, that they can come to some sort of resolution, some sort of agreement, to put more money on the table and to change the way that it's spent so that the countries, the poorer countries that are suffering the most, get some benefit from it.
What do you think the sort of the mood is in terms of the scale of the ambition?
I think the mood is pretty realistic and pretty bleak, to be honest, because obviously we've had the election of Donald Trump in the United States. But I do think, in fairness to the organisers, who have been castigated as being another petrostate, I think they are trying hard and they're looking to make progress here. They've managed to get agreement from all the countries here on the last outstanding element of the Paris Agreement. They've managed to get some agreement on that this evening. And I think people are ultra realistic. They know that the odds are stacked against them, but they also know the climate challenge is huge, real, present, and the only way of dealing with it effectively is collectively, and that this is the only real means that the world has of doing that.
And that was Matt McGrath, environment correspondent at those COP talks in Baku. Harjeet Singh is a climate activist, currently Global Engagement Director for the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. He's also at the talks in Baku. Does he agree that the mood, as Matt put it, is a bit bleak?
Things are indeed very bleak, because if I talk about the main agenda at this COP29, which is new climate finance goal, we have been discussing it over the last 3 years. And we have had several rounds of meetings, yet we are not able to agree on a number of aspects that are absolutely crucial for this new climate finance goal, which is going to replace $100 billion annual target, which was set in 2015, and which was supposed to be delivered starting 2020. As Matt briefly mentioned, we now need trillions annually and not billions. Developed countries have not indicated what that quantum going to be, whereas developing countries have been demanding at least $1 trillion. There are three sets of demands coming from Africa, Arab countries, and India. All are $1 trillion or above. Second point is going to be about quality. Now, developed countries in the past goal that they claim to have achieved of $100 billion was full of loans, about 69% as per their own admission. Now, if you provide loans when developing countries are already suffering from the debt crisis, it's going to intensify that. It has to be predominantly grants and concessional loans, highly concessional loans. That conversation is really not happening. On the contrary, and they're trying to narrow the recipient base. They're saying only least developed countries, small island states, and some fragile countries. So can you imagine, after 3 years, we've not really agreed on even one of these aspects, and here we are, where we have to now finalize the new climate finance goal in 15 days. Looks pretty impossible.
I wonder what you make in that case of the chair of this UN climate summit, the Azerbaijan environment minister, saying that actually he thinks it's the private sector that could step in and help this climate adaptation, because presumably that precisely will be in the form of loans.
Well, the reality is the private sector has not delivered on even mitigation, the emission reduction, which is supposedly seen as something that markets are going to deliver. They have not. In fact, if you look at the target of $100 billion, the mobilization of private finance was very little, and a large part had to be loans coming as part of public finance. Now, on adaptation, there's a report which indicates that only 2% of adaptation finance comes from private sources because it's not a money-making venture. Adaptation, which means helping people build dikes and retrofit their homes and having access to early warning systems, that's not a money-making activity. It's something that should come from public finance. It's a public welfare activity. So private sector is not interested. So I don't know how the presidency or even rich countries who claim that private sector is going to provide money for adaptation or even loss and damage, which means helping people recover from climate impacts, no data actually backs that. So we cannot rely on private sector. We need public finance, which means grants from government budgets of the developed world.
Climate adaptation is clearly one thing. The other thing is, of course, our need to move away from our reliance on fossil fuels. Given Donald Trump's election, given those around him who have suggested that they're going to push much harder in terms of fossil fuel extraction in the United States, what do you think would be a measure of success out of these 15 days in Azerbaijan in terms of trying to push that transition forward?
Well, what we got at COP28 last year in Dubai was historic. For the first time in 30 years, we could land a decision that talked about transitioning away from fossil fuels. It was not perfect. It had many loopholes. It talked about unproven technologies and what we call as false solutions of offsets and even carbon markets. Having said that, it was still a breakthrough where the world realized that we have to move away from fossil fuels. But with Trump's election and the U.S., which has an outsized responsibility because of its historical carbon footprint and even being the top fossil fuel producer, not being at the table is not helpful. It's a devastating setback that we have got. But developed countries as a bloc have been negotiating. They took the collective responsibility of reducing emissions and providing finance. Now they cannot back out. They have to step up and fill the gap. Another point I should also make, Tim, the role of U.S. over the last 30 years has not been encouraging. In fact, U.S. has been obstructing negotiations and watering down these agreements and even pulled out of Paris Agreement. So in that context, we were not relying on the U.S. for a huge amount of money if they never delivered. So now other countries cannot hide behind this excuse that U.S. is not there, so they're going to rather reduce it. In fact, as I said, they should bump up and they should ratchet up their ambition as well as provide more money, because that's what is needed right now to give confidence to developing countries who have to change their energy sector. And for that, they would like to see predictable, reliable source of money. And if that doesn't happen, as the UNEP emissions gap report made it very clear just a few weeks ago, all those conditional pledges that developing countries have made will not be fulfilled. And that's going to be devastating. So what we heard from WMO today, this being the hottest year, we are going to see many more devastating impacts in the years to come.
And that was Harjeet Singh, climate activists in Baku for COP29. This is NewsHour. Coming up on the programme ahead of the second season of the hit Netflix series Squid Game, its creator tells our correspondent in Seoul of the toll it has taken on him.
I read that you were so stressed during the first series that you lost 6 teeth. Is that true?
8 or 9 teeth.
8 or 9 teeth. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And he's still laughing about it. You can hear him and our correspondent Jean McKenzie reporting from Seoul in about 30 minutes. One headline, it's something we'll be discussing in about 25 minutes. The Saudi Crown Prince has described Israel's actions in Gaza as genocide and said Palestine deserves a full seat at the United Nations. With the BBC World Service and live from London, this is NewsHour. Victims of one of the most prolific online child abusers ever to be convicted have said that they hope more people will report sex crimes. They've been speaking in a new BBC documentary series focusing on the prosecution of Alexander McCartney from Northern Ireland. He used a false identity on the internet. It's known as catfishing. McCartney pretended to be a teenaged girl to trick children into sending him explicit photos of themselves. He then blackmailed them into carrying out acts of abuse. This report from our island correspondent Chris Page begins with the distressing testimony of some of McCartney's victims.
I just felt dirty. Tore some of my innocence out.
get these pictures or blast it all over the internet. I don't want to live in that world. Like, that's terrifying.
I felt like it just wasn't going to end. I was curled up against my door in my room, crying.
Alexander McCartney was a relentless and remorseless abuser. Police think he targeted 3,500 children. Ivy was in New Zealand.
At 12, I was very much like a nerd. It was hard making friends. I just remember feeling weirded out but kind of flooded at the same time. A girl's interested in me. It was exciting. She sent images first.
She says that when she sent McCartney an explicit picture of herself, he turned on her.
I will send these to your friends and family. It's going to be everywhere. Unless you send me more. I was just confused and scared.
The victims who've taken part in the BBC documentary series called Teen Predator Online Killer have spoken out in the hope it'll help others. We're protecting their identities, so we aren't using their real names, but they have chosen to speak with their real voices.
I think doing this will help me a lot, to feel closure. Just feeling like I'm wrapping up, like, this chapter of my life.
Emily's from the US state of Oregon. McCartney used her image in his fake identity online.
He used my photos to catfish other girls, and it does make me angry. I did feel trapped, and I didn't feel like I could talk to anyone. I was kind of just asking myself, like, who's doing this? Is it someone I know? At the time, I was questioning if maybe it was people from my school doing this to me as, like, a prank. It felt very real.
Would you state your name and date of birth for me?
Alexander McCartney, 2nd of 4th, 1998.
The series also shows McCartney's police interviews for the first time. Detectives question him about a message a victim received from the abuser, who called himself Chloe.
She says there was a message from Chloe. She said, "I'm a catfish." Do you know what that means?
Yeah, from the TV show Catfish.
What is it? Explain it to me.
No comment.
What's a catfish?
No comment.
Come on, Alex, you know what a catfish is.
No comment.
At the moment, we have 266 victims. There's 6 in Australia, 2 in Belgium, 12 in Canada, 1 in Colombia, Croatia, Denmark, Germany, Italy, Latvia, Lithuania, Mexico, Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Poland, Slovakia, Spain, Sweden, and 214 in the USA. Those figures are going to rise.
They did. Police say most of McCartney's victims were aged between 10 and 14. He ordered some to abuse other children. Detectives recount discovering more than 200,000 photos on one of McCartney's devices. They were what's termed first-generation pictures. In other words, they were of new victims.
I have never seen a folder structure such as this. It's vast.
The first download shows me the largest number of first-generation images to be captured on a device, certainly within the UK, potentially worldwide.
Contributors to the documentary hope more people will feel able to come forward to report crimes like McCartney's. Violet says she's glad she spoke to police.
People have lost their lives over this. I reported him and he got caught. Speak out, because you truly never know the magnitude of the situation you're dealing with.
A victim who we're calling Violet, ending that report from our island correspondent Chris Page. My colleague Rebecca Kesby has been speaking to one of those involved in catching Alexander McCartney. He's Special Agent Paul Wolpert from the Department for Homeland Security. He's based in Virginia in the United States.
I became involved when one of the victims that we identified through this investigation reported it to our local law enforcement here in Virginia. And once we realized that the subject was in the UK, we reached out to try and figure out who that might be. And ultimately, we found out he had already been identified.
The US and the UK do have very good relations, don't they, on things such as security and policing, that sort of thing. But I mean, some of these countries, well, they're all over the world, aren't they? Did you have issues trying to coordinate the legal response in other countries?
I can say that when I found out if there was a victim located in another country, I forwarded the information to our offices over there in the UK, including the PSNI that we were working with, and then they took it from there. So I didn't directly have any involvement with the other countries outside of Northern Ireland.
But most countries were keen to try to help if they could.
Oh, I believe so. Yeah, I think when it comes to child exploitation, I kind of find it hard to believe any countries would not take that seriously.
I mean, this must be very difficult work for all the police officers involved and the sort of material that you'd have to be dealing with. It can't be easy for the police officers involved.
This is probably the most serious type of crime that we investigate because it does involve child victims. Sometimes it's children that are not old enough that they can speak for themselves. So, yes, it definitely is probably one of the hardest types of violations that we investigate.
And how do you deal with that?
Well, I've been doing it for 20 years. So, over time, you just move on and do the best you can and think about the good that you're doing. And, in the meantime, you'll catch the violators. So I guess you can look at it as it's a win for us, especially the victims.
But I suppose the fact that this McCartney character was able to be so prolific worldwide, it does show the relative ease with which such abusers could work. And I suppose the fear is that there are others out there.
Yeah, there's absolutely somebody else out there. And that's our problem is we don't monitor the internet. We can only act when somebody reports it. And in this case with sextortion or the catfishing, it's probably one of the biggest violations where somebody can reach the most amount of people in a short amount of time and victimize hundreds and in this case, thousands of victims.
And what would you say to anyone who has been a victim, but who's just too embarrassed to tell anyone or say anything or look for help?
Please report it. That's the only way we can do something. And go to a specialized person, not just a uniformed officer, because they're not really trained on how to deal with this. We have had people report and they just didn't get any results because the individual didn't know what to do. So look for a sex crimes investigator, but we absolutely need to hear it because that's the only way we can do anything. Mm-hmm. And please don't delete anything. And I'd like to say you're not going to be in trouble. We need to let parents know that they can't let their kids feel like they're going to be in trouble if they report something like this, because we do find that a lot. They're afraid to report because they don't want to get their phones taken. They think they're going to be in trouble. And we just need to make sure that they aren't, or at least they know that.
And that was Special Agent Paul Wolpert from Homeland Security in Virginia in the United States, speaking to my colleague Rebecca Kesby. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. Passenger plane heading for the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, had to be diverted to the neighbouring Dominican Republic after it was hit by gunfire. Spirit Airlines said the plane had been damaged, taken out of commission, and it said that a flight attendant was also injured in the shooting. The news happened on the same day as a new Haitian prime minister was being sworn in following the ousting of the former acting prime minister, Gary Conille. I spoke to Jacqueline Charles, a reporter with the Miami Herald, who covers Haitian affairs, just before the Prime Minister was formally sworn in. What else could she tell us about the plane?
The plane was headed into Port-au-Prince. It was about a mile from the airport, having left Fort Lauderdale with a lot of passengers. And I spoke to a passenger on board the plane and said they were basically getting ready to land when they heard clack, 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 and then the metal and the plastic. And then that's when some of them realized that they had been struck by gunshots. The pilot circled the airport and then diverted to Santiago in the Dominican Republic.
Right. Do we know anything about this flight attendant who's been injured? I mean,
Spirit Airlines says just minor injuries, but no passengers were injured. Those passengers now are being flown back to Fort Lauderdale. The airline has announced a cancellation of all of its flights into Haiti, including the northern city of Cap Haitien, until further notice. American Airlines and JetBlue have also announced that they have suspended flights into Port-au-Prince at least until Thursday.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of underlines just the level of chaos, dysfunction and violence. And now we have a new prime minister who's been sworn in. Tell me who this person is and the background to Gary Coney being ousted.
Yeah, so Alexis Defizeme, who is a businessman in Port-au-Prince, he previously ran unsuccessfully for the Haitian Senate in 2015. He is being sworn in today as we speak, and his swearing in comes in after the ruling presidential body, the 9-member Transitional Presidential Council, which was mounted earlier this year with the assistance of the U.S. and Caribbean community. They decided to oust Prime Minister Gary Coney. For weeks, Gary Coney and members of the council have been at loggerheads over a number of issues, specifically a reshuffling that the body was asking for, and also the fate of 3 members of the council who are accused in a bank bribery corruption scandal. Prime Minister Coney did not attend today's swearing in. Some members of his government did. We do not know what his next steps are going to be, but he has protested this move as being illegal.
Will the U.S. recognize this new prime minister?
Well, that's what we're waiting to see. I mean, the U.S. ambassador is not in Haiti at the moment, but we're looking to see whether or not the U.S. chargé is among the members of the diplomatic corps who attended today's ceremony. There are members of the diplomatic corps that are there. We have to remember the United States, the Biden administration is currently in a transition. I mean, yeah. They're basically going to be leaving. And so, you know, there's a lot of questions in terms of what they're willing to do or not willing to do in this situation.
And that was Jacqueline Charles from the Miami Herald. She covers Haitian affairs. You're with the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London, with me, Tim Franks. One of the truisms around Donald Trump's election victory is that it's likely to shake things up internationally as well as at home. In a moment, we'll look at what that might mean in the Middle East. But we'll begin with the war in Ukraine. Mr. Trump said last year that Vladimir Putin would never have launched a full invasion had he, Donald Trump, still been in the White House in 2022. He also insisted during this election campaign that he could end the war within a day. Given that Ukraine is also under such severe pressure along much of its eastern front line and also down south, even some of its supporters in the West are beginning to ask when might be the time for a concerted push for peace, or at least a peace deal. Professor Timothy Garton-Ash is a historian and author of Homelands, A Personal History of Europe. Sir Anthony Brenton is the UK's former ambassador in Moscow. Timothy Garton-Ash, first of all, what does he make of these rumblings seemingly suggesting Ukraine should be encouraged to make a deal with Russia?
First of all, the situation, the military situation is extremely precarious. The front line is thin. There's a danger of it breaking. And that's partly because we, the West, did not give enough support soon enough. And the U.S. Congress spent 6 months not giving the needed aid. Now, the impending danger for Ukraine is not that we will strongly urge them to negotiate, because they themselves have been saying that they want a peace negotiation and they want Russia at the table. The danger is that Trump will threaten to cut U.S. aid to Ukraine, which has been crucial, military and economic aid, in order to compel them to accept a settlement that would in fact be a capitulation. And it's a settlement that the vice president-elect, J.D. Vance, has suggested, which is not only that you accept de facto, in reality, that for the foreseeable future you're not going to get back that vast tract of Ukrainian territory, 20% of the country, a territory as large as Portugal and Slovenia combined, not only that you accept that, but that you should be neutral, that you should not become part of the West. And so the crucial question is, what would be the terms that the West supports? If it goes that way, that is an outright victory for Vladimir Putin. And that's exactly what he's asked for. The country should be neutral. If the West says, the alternative, if the West says, okay, we're supporting you for talks, but in the meantime, we're going to keep up the military support so you can at least stabilize the front line, and we're going to bring the 80% of Ukraine that is controlled by the government in Kiev, firmly into the West, which means ultimately EU and NATO, but military security guarantees along the way. That's a realistic proposition for a negotiation.
And Tony Brenton, how do you read things?
Tim's got it largely right, but I would take a rather different view of it. The fact is that Putin has lost this war. It is very clear that whatever outcome we get to, we're going to end up with at least 80% of Ukraine free, democratic, linked to the West. Whether or not it is neutral is actually a slightly subsidiary question, because you can always arrange security arrangements which guarantee its protection from Russia. If you're going to get a deal, however, you need something which the Russians can also buy and, you know, can take back to their people, and Putin can claim a success on his side. Otherwise, you don't have an agreement, and therefore you have a continuing war. And it's pretty clear what Putin needs. Firstly, he needs to retain Crimea, whether de jure or de facto. And secondly, he needs Ukraine to be kept out of NATO. Now, it's not difficult to see a route to a deal which delivers for both sides, us the West, a free, democratic Ukraine, part of the West, and delivers to Putin his ability to claim that he's achieved his objectives. Getting there, well, it's been impossible for the last 2 years. And I think the arrival of Trump is helpful, because up until now, while Russia has talked reasonably accessibly about a sort of deal which we freeze conflict on the existing battle lines, we leave territorial decisions for a subsequent negotiation, we keep Ukraine out of NATO, and we do deal on security arrangements, Ukraine has been completely unbudging on its demands for total withdrawal by Russia from Ukrainian lands, fraud by war crimes charges against Russia, for reparations against Russia, all of which sounds morally entirely desirable. But we're not in a moral arena anymore. We're in a, if I may say so, a diplomatic arena where you find the deal you can do. I think that Trump and his ability to pressure actually both sides could well helpfully push us in that direction.
And I wonder, Timothy Garton-Ash, whether it's not just about Trump, but it is also about, I mean, Europe is not agreed on the need to face down Moscow, it seems. I mean, there does seem to be, you know, a real, not antipathy towards Ukraine, but a real reluctance to be embroiled when you think about, I mean, not just Hungary and Slovakia, but, you know, a lot of the populist parties in France and Germany and so forth, and perhaps they need to be taken into account.
That may indeed be where we end up, but I just want to be very clear. What Tony Brenton has described is a defeat for Ukraine. Nobody in Ukraine, and we've done polling on this, would see that as a victory. And I very much disagree. I think that Putin would regard an outcome in which he had got back this vast tract of territory. I mean, it's much, much more than Crimea, as I said. It's a huge tract of territory where millions of Ukrainians lived until very recently. He would call it Novorossiya, the new Russia, the term from the time of Catherine the Great, and secured his goal of neutrality. That, for him, is a great victory. So it may well be, and by the way, would be seen by the rest of the world, and we have good polling evidence on this, as a defeat not just for Ukraine, but also for the West.
And just very briefly, Tony Brenton, because time is short, and forgive me, but I mean, do you think that the idea that this conflict could be frozen, that that's a bit of a sort of a mirage with Putin?
No, it's not a mirage with Putin. I mean, Putin has lived with a lot of frozen conflicts, actually, over the last few years. Putin, the Russians know they've lost. They've had a catastrophic military performance. They can't stop Ukraine becoming part of the West. They have to salvage enough to save Putin's face with his own people and with the wider world. There is emerging a deal which does that. Timothy's right that it would, in a perfect world, he would be crushed and thrown out of his job and all the rest of it. But in the world we live in, you have to negotiate, which means that both sides have to come out of it with something that they can sell as a success.
And that was the former British ambassador to Russia, Sir Anthony Brenton. You also heard from the historian and author, Timothy Garton-Ash. Turn from the possible Trump effect in Ukraine to how things might change in the Middle East. What in particular should we read into the latest comments from the leaders of Saudi Arabia, one of the key power brokers in the Middle East? With war and instability roiling the region, the Saudis called today an emergency regional meeting to discuss Gaza and Lebanon. And our security correspondent Frank Gardner was there in the capital, Riyadh.
I get the sense that they are absolutely determined to send one big unified voice with a number of messages that the conflicts have to stop, that Israel, in their view, is breaking humanitarian law. The Saudi foreign minister accused it of trying to cause starvation in Gaza. The crown prince, who is a US ally, said that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. They've also demanded a return to the two-state solution. In other words, an independent Palestinian state alongside the state of Israel, something which this Israeli government has absolutely ruled out. So it kind of begs the question, what is the point of this great big grand summit? So I did actually put exactly that question to the Saudi foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud. He said, look, the aim of all of this is to show enough is enough and that this can't go on. I mean, he said very explicitly, the UN or the international community has failed Gaza.
You've got great experience of being a Saudi watcher, Frank. Do you get a sense that they see something of an opportunity to recast or to improve somehow their role in the Middle East?
Well, I think there is. They've got a much more thrusting, forward-leaning foreign policy than they used to have. They used to be the shy, retiring violets of the diplomatic world in the Middle East. They left it all up to Egypt, pretty much. That has changed. They've got, as I say, a close relationship with Donald Trump. I think the Saudis are very pleased to see him come back. They didn't have a close relationship with President Biden, who they have not forgotten, said not that long ago that Saudi Arabia needed to be made the pariah that it is. Whereas Donald Trump likes this country, partly through his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He's made good contacts here. But the tectonic plates, I think, are shifting once again in this region. It wasn't that long ago that Saudi Arabia and Iran were the two big regional heavyweight rivals, with Iran backing the Houthis in Yemen, as they still do, and arming them and allowing them to send missiles from Yemen into Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia bombing the heck out of the Houthis and other targets in Yemen. That ended with a Chinese-brokered handshake in March last year. And now you've got the heads of the Saudi military meeting with the heads of Iran's regular military, not the Revolutionary Guards, importantly, but the regular army. There are kind of two armies in Iran. But the Saudis are reaching out to the Iranians because they frankly think, we're on our own. We can't rely on anybody. We live in a tough region. We're going to have to make our own way and make our own friends. They will be hoping that President Trump, and I know this is going to sound contrary to what most people think in Europe, that he's actually going to bring stability. That one editorial, for example, in a leading newspaper here, Arab News, was titled "A Sign of Hope, Donald Trump Returns, and a Hope for More Stability." That's the way a lot of people view it here.
It is fascinating, isn't it? Because it just, it shows that the sort of old equations are changing a little bit. I mean, the fact that you say, you know, Saudi probably has more in common with Donald Trump and is also having something of a rapprochement with Iran. But at the same time, we know that Donald Trump is very hostile to Iran, even more antipathetic than the current administration. The picture's being shaken, isn't it?
It is being shaken. One of the things that I find quite surprising, but I suppose I shouldn't, is the presence of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad here. This guy was a pariah for 12 years. The Arab League kicked Syria out because of the brutal repression that Syria's president ordered for the Arab Spring protests in his country. Its police stations and prisons are full of torture chambers. Arab ministers have said to me that that man has blood on his hands, and yet here he is welcomed and speaking with a completely straight face, talking about Israeli aggression when his own forces have committed unbelievable human rights violations off the scale.
And that was our security correspondent Frank Gardner speaking from Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, just in terms of the war between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. The new foreign minister in Israel, Gideon Saar, said certain progress had been made in trying to end that war. But the new defence minister, Yisrael Katz, said there'll be no ceasefire in Lebanon until the goals of the war are achieved. This is NewsHour. From the BBC World Service now. I am no astronomer, but I think it's fair to say that the planet Uranus has had on balance a bit of a bad press over the years. The seventh planet is seen as crisply, seventh planet from the sun, is seen as crisply beautiful, but sterile and icy with it. Now, though, scientists are wondering whether Uranus has been undersold. New analysis has been published in the journal Nature Astronomy, and it suggests that our existing view may have come from a misunderstood flyby from a probe almost 40 years ago, and that there could once have been conditions for life, at least on the planet's moons. Dr. William Dunn is with the Department of Physics and Astronomy at University College London and co-authored the study.
Basically, everything we know about the system is based on that 1986 flyby, and the spacecraft was only actually at Uranus for about 2 days. What we did was we basically zoomed out for an 8-month period to see, well, what's the space weather like at Uranus for the 4 months before and the 4 months after the flyby. And what we found is that actually, I guess it's a cosmic coincidence that it arrived there at exactly the same moment that a huge, very extreme solar wind event just smashed into the planet. And so what that means is that the whole scientific community, to be honest, has been really puzzled by all of these mysterious, weird, extreme behaviors that Uranus seems to have. But all of those are kind of put in context by the fact that actually it entirely happened at the same moment that a huge solar storm hit the planet.
Right. So in other words, that sort of skewed our view of Uranus and sort of made us think that it is this icy wasteland, an extraordinary place, a strange place, but not a place that could conceivably harbour life.
So we know there are lots of moons around other planets that seem to have water oceans. So there's a moon around Jupiter called Europa that has oceans and oceans of water, more water than there is on all of Earth. We think amongst the places in space that we know of, that could be one of the most likely places to harbour life. There's also a moon at Saturn called Enceladus, and that has water oceans. And again, we think, well, it has oceans, and we know that life first formed here on Earth in oceans. So possibly that could also be a place that might support life. The reason that we didn't think any of the Uranian oceans were like that is because when Voyager flew past the system, it didn't find any evidence of water at all. But now in the context of this huge solar storm hitting the planet, we think actually that probably would have just cleared all the water out of the system. It would have blown it away, essentially.
And am I right in thinking that absolutely the question is now open and that in another, is it 10 years or so, that there is due to be another probe going past in a way that might be able to investigate?
Yes. So NASA's next big flagship mission to a planet will be an orbiter for Uranus. And importantly, it's an orbiter. It's not going to be one of these flyby events again where you get two momentary days of data and then it's gone. This will spend hopefully years at the planet and particularly understanding the conditions of the moons.
I guess also, I mean, come what may, your study that you've co-authored, it just underscores how important it is not just to do fresh research but to keep an open mind on existing research.
Yeah, I think we have the advantage of 38 years of additional context. We know more about Earth, we know more about Jupiter, we know more about Saturn. And so having all of that context and the importance then of these big solar storms in driving processes at planets really helped us to reevaluate the data in with a different mindset. And so, yes, I think it's important that we go back to past data sets. It's important that we keep an open mind with past data sets. I mean, it's amazing that humanity really launches these spacecraft and they take all of these incredible measurements and we have this huge body of knowledge based on that. And so utilizing that, I think, to its fullest is really important moving forward.
William Dunn from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at University College London. From science to science fiction and the smash hit Squid Game. The dystopian South Korean TV series came out 3 years ago. It was the biggest hit ever for Netflix, a massive boost to the profile of Korean TV drama. But just as fans await the release of series two, the country's film and TV producers say that their industry is facing a serious cash flow crisis. Our Seoul correspondent Jean McKenzie has this report.
We're just walking now into the dormitory set, so the set with all the beds where the contestants sleep at night. Squid Game is a dystopian thriller where hundreds of fictional contestants
deep in debt, fight it out to win a huge cash prize by playing a series of children's games. Only the winner gets to survive. But it's not just the contestants that have suffered in the making. So has its creator, director Hwang Dong-hyuk.
I read that you were so stressed during the first series that you lost 6 teeth. Is that true?
8 or 9 teeth.
8 or 9 teeth. Mm-hmm. Wow. The first series was a social commentary about inequality in Korea. Is there going to be a new theme in the second series?
We've seen recently that conflicts in Korea and elsewhere don't just end with the rich and poor. They're playing out between different generations, genders, and political camps. We're entering an era of us versus them.
Now, at the end of every round, the contestants must pick a side. Do they want to end the game and survive, or keep playing? Majority rules. I'm told this will lead to more fights, more drama. But it's also to prove director Hwang's point that forcing people to pick sides fuels conflict.
You didn't want to do a second series.
Yes.
You were adamant. So why did you change your mind?
Money.
Even though the first series was such a huge global success, honestly, I didn't make much. So doing the second series will help compensate me for the success of the first one too.
Hwang was only paid an upfront fee, meaning he couldn't cash in on the show's enormous success. This is a problem across the industry. Netflix and other streaming platforms have pumped loads of money into Korea. They bought it worldwide recognition. But because of how they operate, the creators say they've been left with little to show for it. Here in Seoul, writers, directors and actors have gathered determined to fight the current system. Korean content is facing a serious crisis, they declare. They want the government to change the law, to force streaming platforms to share out their profits. The new series of Squid Game, which is out over Christmas, will surely give the industry another boost. But as for director Hwang's teeth, when I caught up with him after filming, it didn't look so good.
I think I still got the toothache, so probably I have to pull out a couple more. We'll see. I haven't seen my dentist yet.
I love the fact that he's still laughing in that dark fashion. The Squid Game creator Hwang Dong-hyuk talking about visiting the dentist. He was speaking to Jean McKenzie, our Seoul correspondent. From all of us on NewsHour, thanks for listening.